Welcome to Court and Controversy. I'm Janine Yunus. On this program, I'll be discussing a wide variety of controversial topics with some of the most original thinkers of our time, and no holds barred. I bring a litigator's perspective, and my guests will come from different backgrounds and industries. Enjoy the show. My guest today is Jay Bhattacharya, who probably doesn't need an introduction, but he's an epidemiologist at Stanford University and one of the co-authors of the Great Barrington Declaration. I met Jay almost 4 years ago in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, the weekend that Martin Kulldorff and Sunetra Gupta co-authored the Great Barrington Declaration. And here we are almost 4 years later, and we had a setback in our censorship case against the government. This is a case in which Jay, Martin, Aaron Cariotti, and Jill Hines alleged that they were censored on social media, ultimately at the government's behest, for their COVID dissenting opinions, especially on Twitter, but also on LinkedIn and possibly Instagram and Facebook. So, Jay, our decision came on Wednesday, and the court ultimately 6-3 opinion, with the majority holding that you and the other plaintiffs did not have standing. What was your reaction to the decision?
I mean, I was very, very disappointed. Jeannie, as you remember, we were at the oral arguments together. And in fact, I was sitting next to you. And as the oral, I came into those oral arguments. I've never sat in on any oral arguments before Supreme Court. What do I know about the law, right? I came into those oral arguments in, like, it was March of this year, convinced that the Supreme Court was going to be a 9-0 decision in our favor. Like, how on earth could it possibly be that in the United States, the government could tell social media companies censor these people and these ideas, and somehow that's consistent with the First Amendment, right? And I remember sitting next to you as the oral arguments unfolded, I became more and more crestfallen at what the tenor of the arguments. It was very clear that the Supreme Court justices were not automatically in favor of free speech as I thought they would have been. And then you put a little note on your, you put a little notes and you wrote, Jay, we're going to lose. And unfortunately, you turned out to be right. I mean, it was so I'd steeled myself for that possibility, but still seeing it in print that we actually had lost the case was like a gut punch.
Yeah, well, so I think there are pros and cons to losing it on standing. First of all, they at least did not say that the government's conduct was acceptable or not violative of the First Amendment. I mean, in fact, they specifically said in the footnote that they weren't addressing the merits. And for those who don't know, we had won in the district court in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. So we were up on two wins, basically, and the government had appealed that. And so they said that they weren't going to address the Fifth Circuit's finding that the government had coerced and significantly encouraged the social media platforms to censor the content that at issue related to COVID and also elections and the Hunter Biden laptop and a few other topics. But unfortunately, the finding on standing is also pretty problematic because it means that in reality, a lot of plaintiffs will sort of be barred from the courthouse doors. And it means I'm not even sure who can bring this case, although we should talk about that because that's an interesting question.
Well, I think so on the question of whether the government did censor, and there's no question about that. Like, you look at the evidentiary record that you all developed in the case, and it's absolutely overwhelming. Right, you have Facebook sometimes telling the government this. You have, like, people like within the government, people like Rob Flaherty in the White House, you know, a direct aide to President Biden, reaching out to Facebook and saying, look, you have to censor these people, these ideas, vaccine injured groups with true stories of vaccine injury, and if you don't do it, there's this implied threat, right? And sometimes you have Facebook pushing back, saying, look, these guys are saying true things. They're not violating our terms of service. Why should we do this? And it's interesting because there's a weaponizations task force that's been looked into this. And what they found was, like, internal emails inside Facebook where they're discussing the censorship demands by the government. And they're saying, look, we need the government to, like, negotiate with us on behalf of us and with the European Union, like, because the European Union wants to, like, fine us a gazillion dollars. This is Facebook, a gazillion dollars or whatever because of their censorship laws. And essentially, like, they're saying, look, we have to comply with these censorship orders or we're not going to be able to get the kinds of services we normally would expect from an American government.
Yeah, exactly.
There's an implied threat.
Yeah, well, so I served on that committee for a few months, and that was actually the last thing I did was work on the project where we turned up those emails. And one of the best ones was, well, best, was Nick Clegg, who's an executive at Meta, was emailing with another employee and saying, can you remind me why we censored the lab leak theory? And the other employee said, because we were under pressure from the White House, we shouldn't have done it, which is pretty clear proof that the censorship was happening because of the government. And all along, one of the government's arguments had been, well, sure, we're like telling the companies what we'd like. We're expressing our own opinion and our own First Amendment rights to say what our preferences would be. But there's no evidence the government actually did things because we told them to, which, first of all, there were quite a few emails that contradicted that, where Facebook was saying, okay, we'll sort of strengthen our policies, we'll enforce them more stringently, we'll take another look at that and, you know, just start censoring more. So we already knew that, but this was so clear. I mean, they're saying we did this because of the White House. Unfortunately, those weren't in the record because the briefing had already been completed in the Fifth Circuit by the time we got those emails. So that's another sort of technicality that I think was very unfortunate. And the dissent actually cited those emails.
But, you know, the other thing about that is that that may be true, but what was already in the record was bad enough, right? It led the Terry Doughty, the federal district court judge, to say that this was an Orwellian ministry of truth.
And right? The most massive attack on free speech in the United States history. He said arguably, to be
yeah.
fair.
Yeah. and then the district court, the appeals court, their view of the matter was that the government was acting like a gangster. The analogy was to Al Capone, right? Going to a Chicago right. business and saying, look, that's a nice business you got there. Wouldn't be terrible if something were to happen to it.
Right.
And that's based on just the evidence base that we had developed, or we, you guys, you know, the lawyers in the case had developed. And so it was really striking to me in reading Amy Coney Barrett's things that she starts with this entire decision is based on standing and standing alone. There's nothing else. We're not saying anything at all about whether the government actually violated the First Amendment or not. It's just these guys don't have the standing to sue.
I know you're not a lawyer, but do you have any thoughts about why they might have chosen to dodge the, you know, substantive issue of the First Amendment violation?
Okay, so let me just preface this with I every time I post about the law online, I get mauled by lawyers who are like, oh no, you don't understand the difference between procedural and substantive law.
Well, so do I. So,
but I'll say this, and you led with this, and I completely agree with it. You have you got a situation where the procedural decision to like apply some arcane rules about standing to us, to exclude us, even though we were censored, as a reason to not rule on the case, is itself substantive in impact. Even if it's not substantive sure. in a legal sense, it's substantive in a policy sense.
It might be worse in that respect. That's why, because I was thinking, well, okay, it's better that they're not saying that this conduct is okay. But on the other hand, they're barring basically everybody from the courthouse doors. And also, you said sort of based on this arcane standing, I think they actually changed the standing doctrine in order to reach this conclusion in the case. There, you know, there was quite a bit of case law in the case the Fifth Circuit relied on, Department of Commerce, that said basically if the government is engaging this in this conduct and the third parties are reacting in predictable ways, the individual bringing this suit doesn't have to show that their injury was because of the government. And so who is going to be able to show this? I mean, there are maybe a couple of people who have been specifically targeted in emails from the government, like Alex Berenson and RFK Jr., where government officials basically told the platforms to get them off. And then they were, you know, shortly thereafter, they were kicked off the platforms. But so there are a few people. I think you have to be pretty prominent. The average person, nobody's saying get, you know, the White House isn't sending emails to Facebook saying get Jeanine Unis or Kathy Jones off Facebook. So this means that it's going to be more or less prominent individuals who can maybe successfully bring these suits, if even them. I mean, even RFK Jr., there's no direct evidence that he was actually kicked off because of the government. There's circumstantial evidence, which is what you and Martin and Jill had and Aaron. But not direct. I mean, the government made demands that he get off the platform, but they didn't react right away. So he was at some point removed, but you can't prove that he was taken off because of the platforms. So I'm not sure who can bring a lawsuit under these circumstances.
You know, Alito's dissent was really good on this, on this fact. So, like, so basically, if under this doctrine we now have that the majority in the Supreme Court has reached, basically what happens then is that if I can't show some government flack writing to some Facebook or Twitter or someone, that saying, look, censor Jay saying this because it's bad. Well, if I can't show that, then I don't have standing.
Yeah.
Right. Like, if I understand the term of art, it was traceability. Right. Can I trace the particular act of censorship to a demand direct from the government to the third party, in this case, Twitter or whatever, that says put Jay on a blacklist? And if you can't produce an email that says that, now there's a few things about that. One is that how on earth would you know? If you're just a regular person, like, even if you're not, if you're just me, I don't know. I suspect the government has an involvement, and I don't have really the wherewithal to sue. This was a very unique circumstance where you had two state attorney generals deciding to like bring this suit, which allowed us to get discovery. It's only via discovery that you would discover such an email, because like,
exactly.
They're doing it behind closed doors.
And I discovered that lesson the even harder way, because I brought a suit earlier called Changizi versus HHS, and it got kicked out on standing, and they did essentially the Sixth Circuit, and also the district court before it, did essentially the same analysis where they said, well, sure, the government was demanding that the platforms remove COVID so-called misinformation. Your clients were censored for COVID misinformation, but we don't know that their censorship occurred because of the government, since the platforms had content moderation policies before. It didn't matter that they had clearly escalated. I mean, the Supreme Court even said in your case that it was clear that the government's influence was playing some role in the content moderation policies. And under the current law, that should be enough. It's very clear that for some reason, they really wanted to dodge the issue in this case. And I think the other thing that's important to note is that this was up on a preliminary injunction, up on appeal. So the court said that required a showing of a likelihood of future harm in the near future, that you would probably be censored for the same kind of content in the relatively near future.
I'm going to keep saying what I say. So I'm very likely to be censored for the same kind of content, because this government doesn't like what I'm saying, very clearly from the evidential record we already established. That part was very strange, because if I understood it, they were intimating that if I had asked for monetary damages, then I might have had standing.
I wasn't sure what to make of that sentence. It was weird, because they said if you were seeking compensatory damages, the whole inquiry would be about past conduct, whereas here they were looking at the past conduct only insofar as it was predictive of future conduct. So I'm not really sure what they meant by that, frankly.
It's frankly offensive, right? So I specifically didn't want monetary damage, because I don't want the American taxpayer to pay for the violation of our basic rights that the Biden administration, if anything, it should be the Biden administration, people, individuals within the Biden administration that demanded the censorship should pay. But really what's really needed is they should just stop censoring. The Supreme Court should tell them to stop censoring. That's really what I want. But the Supreme Court essentially says you have to like rob the American taxpayer in order to like have access to the court so that you have a standing to enforce the First Amendment. So Alito really was great on this. Like, it's in the dissent, he says, look, under this ruling, essentially the government can go to social media companies and just say, censor these ideas.
Yeah.
That means no one will ever have standing.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's perfectly legal for the government to do this, because it's the First Amendment is unenforceable. No one can bring a suit to say the government can't do this, so the government can just do this.
Yeah,
and so exactly. The government can censor whatever ideas it wants.
Yeah, as long as it doesn't name specific individuals, apparently. And maybe even if it does, because I think the standard that they've set is so high. I mean, I think they might say, even for somebody like Alex Berenson or RFK Jr., under this analysis, well, you know, COVID's over. You can't really show a likelihood of future harm, even though the platform's content moderation policies have been enforcement, I think, have clearly been influenced by the administration. So I think it's, you know, the whole thing is completely ridiculous.
I mean, so that means any sophisticated scheme, like marginally sophisticated, you just don't have to name anybody. You employ third parties like the Stanford Internet Observatory to launder your censorship demands, launder the demands that the platforms change their policies to bar speech that the government doesn't like. There was no element of was what the government was doing, was it barring false speech or true speech, right? There was no analysis of that. In fact, what you have now in this country, thanks to this ruling, is that the government can legally, apparently with no constitutional violation, go censor true speech it doesn't like.
Yep.
And tell the platforms, censor anyone who says these things. The people who post those true things, their reputations will be harmed because, you know, you'll get this label that says, misinformer on it. This thing is misinformation, harming the reputations of the people that post those true things at the behest of the government. And there's no recourse because there's no email from some government flack to Twitter saying, censor Jay who posted this. It'll be just anyone who says this, you should censor or shadow ban or whatever. And then they shadow ban me and then, okay, no problem. I can't get any recourse. The First Amendment is effectively unenforceable now in this context.
Yeah.
And the government can censor whatever idea it likes. And so there's a tremendous substantive impact, I think, of this ruling.
Right. And actually, we should talk about that. I mean, what role did the censorship play in the scientific discourse around COVID, do you think? And how does this ruling affect scientific inquiry going forward?
I mean, Janine, I think it's fair to say that that on item after item, the government was a primary source of misinformation on COVID science during the pandemic. Right. So just to take a few things, it's necessary to close schools in order to control the spread of the disease. Well, that had already been disproved by the Swedish experience, that there's no such thing as immunity after COVID recovery, that somehow this is a magical coronavirus that doesn't produce immunity. Right. If you posted that there is such a thing as immunity, then you got a misinformation label.
That's what happened to Martin, actually. One of the tweets he got censored for was saying people who had, it wasn't exactly that, but saying people who had natural immunity didn't need the vaccine, nor did children.
Yeah. So or like, you know, Martin is one of the world's top experts in vaccine safety, having developed the statistical framework that the FDA uses to track vaccine safety. And he gets censored for doing a basic analysis. Okay.
And I think the label said this differs from the CDC's advice. I mean, we can get into this later, but keep going. Sorry.
Yeah.
Government's misinformation.
That the vaccine doesn't produce any injuries. If you have a legitimate injury you're not allowed to post it because the government says it's misinformation, even though it's true information that you were injured. Like there were young men who got myocarditis.
Yeah.
Because they took this vaccine. That's a documented fact. And so, you know, the on item after item after item, the government misinformed the public and then used its censorship powers to destroy the reputations of legitimate scientists and regular people who were pointing out that the government got it wrong.
Yeah.
We're in a very dangerous place. I mean, the knock-on effect of that is that other scientists looking at this saying, okay, look, Jay's posting on immunity. It's really clear what the data show. But if I speak up, then I'm going to get this, I'm a misinformer, just like Jay is, label. And that's going to hurt my reputation. So I'm going to stay silent. You
right.
can't have honest scientific conversations in that kind of environment. The free science for the progress of science depends on free speech. It absolutely depends on free speech. You cannot have honest. It's like, you know, so science in the Soviet Union, right? You got a you have a scientific result that Lysenko doesn't like, Stalin doesn't like, and you're going to go to the gulag. So you're not going to say it. You're not going to do it. You're going to end up doing pseudoscience.
And it hurts people. I mean, if people can't get the real information, I think that the debate around lockdowns, mask mandates, vaccine mandates was stifled by this censorship. I mean, some of it was by the tech company's own censorship policies, but it was much more significant because of the government's involvement. So I think people actually got hurt because of these policies.
I mean, I'll go further. I think people are dead today. that would have been alive had we actually had free speech.
Yeah.
Right. So you have people that walked around, vulnerable older people that walked around wearing a cloth mask.
Yeah.
Which everybody now agrees was useless. And the government was telling people wear cloth masks, in effect implying that you'll be safe if you do.
Yep.
And so vulnerable older people in the middle of, you know, December 2020 walked around thinking they were safe when they weren't and are dead today thanks to the government's misinformation, right?
Yeah.
There are vaccine injured young men that might, if they'd been known that there were risks of taking the vaccine that were specific to them in terms of myocarditis, they might not have taken it.
Yeah.
The harms are not hypothetical. They're not just economic. They are real people that were hurt. Their health was hurt. They're dead as a consequence of the censorship effort by the federal government.
That's right. And there was actually, this sounds like a made up story, but it's not made up, I promise. So we represent a bunch of people as well in a lawsuit, Dressen versus Flaherty. And Breanne Dressen is a woman who was vaccine injured. She actually participated in the AstraZeneca COVID vaccine trial. So she wasn't an anti-vaxxer by any means, but she was severely injured. She was diagnosed with neuropathy or something, but she was in a wheelchair for a while. The NIH diagnosed her. I saw the papers as vaccine injured. And she started a bunch of groups on Facebook and other platforms for support groups for people who had injuries to sort of commiserate and also share medical information. And those groups were repeatedly shut down for spreading misinformation, even though a lot of it was private chat groups. They weren't even posting publicly. And one woman who had been severely vaccine injured and was struggling immensely and relied on these groups had been posting, but she could no longer post. And then she committed suicide. That this is a completely true story. And the government had expressly demanded that those groups be removed. They said these vaccine injured groups are spreading misinformation. They need to be taken down. And then they were taken down. So, I mean, this the harm that the government did is really immense. And it's the court's decision here is so deflating. And I think that some of what got lost at the argument was the fact that so much of this was true information. And, the First Amendment protects lies too, for the most part, unless it falls into certain categories like defamation. But I think for the sort of emotional impact and for people to understand why this case is important, it was really significant that it was top scientists being censored on the areas of their expertise, and that this really caused a lot of harm in terms of the public discourse and ultimately to individuals. And I don't think that adequately was addressed at the argument. I don't know what you thought on that front.
I was very frustrated by that. It wasn't addressed at all at the oral argument, as a matter of fact. It was as if the justices, especially the six that voted in the majority, were convinced that the government was telling the God's honest truth all along, and the only problem was that there were some bad people out there that would convince people to do bad things, like the Justice Ketanji Jackson, who her famous hypothetical was that what if there's a social media campaign that goes viral of kids challenging each other to jump out of windows, higher and higher windows. Shouldn't the government have the right to stop that? The irony is it was the government itself that was metaphorically telling the kids to jump out of windows. Like, they closed the schools for a year and a half. There were scientific papers documented, like it in real time published, estimating that we cost our kids, just from the spring school closures alone, 5.5 million life years, because if you miss school, that has long-term consequences in terms of not just learning loss, but you're going to end up living a shorter, poorer life. This is well documented in the social science literature, right? We cost kids a huge amount of anxiety. There was like as depression levels in kids were through the roof, and also their future prospects. The government was essentially telling kids to jump out of windows by closing the schools, metaphorically, the hypothetical was that the government should have the right to stop other people from telling them to jump out of windows. Well, who's going to tell the government that they're causing harm? I mean, that's what the First Amendment is for.
Yeah.
It's completely an outrageous thing.
Do you have any thoughts about why the court did this? I mean, I know we sort of touched on that earlier, but do you see any kind of political motivation or anything like that? I mean, I always think there's something else going on when the court does something that's so outrageous.
Well, I don't know. It's hard for me to, I don't know. I don't really follow the court all that closely. So I don't really know, like, their, I mean, I know that's like vague ideas about their political leanings and all that, but I don't know this, like, raw politics. I do think that there's an element of cowardice here. Like, they didn't want to say to the government that the government got it wrong.
Yeah.
Like, as if somehow, if they were to do that, then the door would be open for a wild west of people just talking to each other, saying whatever they wanted. And there's this, like, sort of bias, this sort of pro-institutional bias, as if somehow what needs to happen is the government needs to protect all the good people of the United States from the raw information feeds that they have, that they don't have no chance of evaluating on their own, because we're all apparently just children to be protected by the government. Like, their notion of what a free citizenship is capable of is just, like, it's just disheartening to think that nine people in power could be so, especially six of them, could be so out of touch. I think there was another element of this. There was another case, I think, if I, and again, Janine, this is, I'm not a lawyer and you are not, so please correct me, but there was a case about the NRA, the National Rifle Association, right? That had been directly, very clearly and provably censored.
Yeah.
Where like some idiot government official went and said to, I forget who, you have to, like, get rid of these guys because they're going to, I don't know the exact facts.
Basically, the regulator, Vulo, who was working under Cuomo, was going to insurance companies and banks and saying, you should stop doing business with the NRA. It's going to be bad for you if you continue to, with, of course, the ultimate aim of getting the NRA to have to disband.
NRA is
it's a First Amendment protected group, since they're expressing a certain viewpoint and they're organized around a certain viewpoint. And the court said that that was a First Amendment violation, that, well, I won't get too technical. It was up on a motion to dismiss. If the facts alleged were true, then that would be a First Amendment violation. The court, and they made the standard coercion. This was clear coercion. One interesting anecdote was the U.S. So this was NRA versus Vulo, who was a New York state elected official. Or sorry, she was not elected. I think she was working under Cuomo. But the United States actually submitted an amicus brief in support of the NRA. And I think that that was a cynical ploy, that they did that in order to say, see, this is real censorship, but the other case is not. And we're being honest here. We're supporting NRA because we're so honest and we're about what actually constitutes censorship.
Right. So the administration basically used it as a shield to say, look, we do support the First Amendment, in the sense of, like, let's go you're not allowed to, the government's not allowed to debank somebody because they don't like their views, right?
Yeah.
But in the more important thing, which is, can people actually talk to each other without the government censoring those ideas online in the public square? A right that is absolutely at the dead center of the First Amendment. The court basically just said, they punted. And maybe the majority on this court were thinking to themselves, well, we're still in favor of the First Amendment because of Vulo, and so we're gonna just let we can be more careful and allow the government to suppress the bad guys who are telling kids to jump out of windows and this other thing.
Yeah, I think perhaps there were some fears about national security, because that's what those are the hypotheticals I've always gotten, is, well, what if the government wants to talk to the social media companies about, or tell the social media companies to get rid of, groups that are spreading disinformation from Iran or China or whatever, with the hope of undermining our elections or our national security. And that's, it's a difficult question and not one I am prepared to answer, but I've always said, well, that's just not this case. But I think the court was maybe worried about the implications of that, and so didn't want to address it. I know that Kavanaugh, who I thought we might have on our side, said basically, when I was working in the executive, we used to tell newspapers all the time that they better not publish a certain story or they'd be in trouble, which I think is a different scenario for various reasons. But also, I'm not sure that that should be acceptable under the First Amendment either.
I mean, I think if you're like the edge cases might be like national security, like someone's publishing secrets, WikiLeaks or something.
Yeah.
Somewhat or someone is publishing child porn, or that someone's doing
well, that's
some
already
criminal thing.
against the law, so you don't
That's
even
the thing. It's like that's not legal speech.
Yeah.
Right? And like you're publishing classified information, there's the New York Times allowed to do it because of like the old free speech cases about the Pentagon Papers. They're allowed to do that, but then other people aren't allowed to publish the classified information in the same. So the New York Times has a special right to free speech, but regular people do not have that special right to free speech.
Yeah.
It's just incoherent, right? So I'd say this is like if you think that national security is going to be like that we're worried about like state actors, Russians are going to come in and disinform a whole bunch of people, right? And all of a sudden Trump will get elected instead of Hillary Clinton. Well, the view that it has of the American people is such a it's so disgust. It's like it's completely outside of what I think normally people think about like Americans are like adult Americans should have the capacity to hear even information from foreign governments and assess them, right? So if the State Department thinks, oh well, look, Russia is disseminating information X and it's not true, well, the State Department has absolutely the right, just like everybody else, to say we think that this is information that's disseminated by. They did this with the Hunter Biden laptop. Right. They said, look, we think this is Russian disinformation, even though it wasn't.
Well, the State Department, the FBI tried to get it censored and actually did so effectively.
Yeah.
But yeah. Well, that's the other.
And then you had 50, like 50 CIA director. I don't know. It was like some crazy amount of number of people with government history of government positions inside the intelligence saying that it was Russian disinformation. And they convinced a lot of the American public that it was. Right. So if they want to counter real foreign falsehoods that they think are damaging, they could very easily do that, apparently.
Yeah. No,
with free speech rights.
That's the other facet of this, is that's what the First Amendment is predicated on, is that the cure for problematic speech, whether it's lies or dangerous in some way or another, is counter speech. And I think I was actually testifying in Congress right when the decision came down, unfortunately. And one of the questions I got asked by a Democratic congressman was, it's like sort of a gotcha. Well, what if some Nazis are posting Nazi material on Twitter? Are you saying the government can't take that down, have the companies take that down? And I said, the appropriate remedy is counter speech. For that, like, I think Americans can read Nazi material and think, no, I don't agree with that. Or, people are welcome to point that out. I don't know why this idea that we're all just going to see something and then believe it and act on it is, I think, very condescending.
I mean, I think the protection for free speech around things like that, I very famously when the Nazis, there was the KKK. They were like going to hold some parade or something in Skokie, Illinois.
Yeah.
The ACLU defended the KKK's right to do that.
Yeah.
Why? Because free speech rights were more important than telling people that the KKK are bad guys. Because you know what? The KKK were bad guys, and you could tell that they were bad guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
I think the remedy, if you think that some people are bad guys, is say they're bad guys. You have free speech rights to say it, and then make your case. Right?
I know, and the idea that because you silence ideas, they go away, I think is problematic too. What happens is they just fester underground. What happened a lot was people who questioned the vaccine and said sort of crazy things like it had a microchip in it, they got kicked off Twitter. What did they do? They went to Gab or Getter, where they were less likely to encounter reasoned opposition to those views. It was more of an echo chamber. So this idea that just because you censor people, suddenly they're all going to stop having these, sometimes crazy ideas, is just wrong.
Yeah. And just to put the loop on this, so like to get back to standing, right? Let's say RFK Jr. or Alex Berenson or someone wins their case. Well, what
or
does that
us.
do?
We could.
Well, I mean, look, we go back and like all of a sudden I'm asking for monetary awards or something, and we win the on the standing, right? Let's say that happens. That actually doesn't solve the problem, right? It leaves still open the reality that the government can go to social media companies and tell them to censor ideas, not people, ideas.
Well, if the court finds they have standing and they can proceed with the claim, the court could issue an injunction saying the government can't. The reason the government wouldn't do the injunction was because, well, maybe they wouldn't have anyway, but was they were saying, well, you don't have standing, so we can't even address this. So theoretically, I don't know that that's true. I think what they've done is make standing almost impossible, if not impossible, to prove in this context. So it might require legislation, which I know is being proposed now. One of the proposals I think is interesting. It requires the government to record or keep public records of any interactions that they have with social media companies. Now, they may just, you know, they may just have these private conversations anyway and not tell the public about it, which wouldn't surprise me anymore. But
yeah, I mean, I think that transparency is one step. Another is why not legislation just makes it illegal, right? If a government official goes to social media companies with a request to ban legal speech, that government official faces fines.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think one of the problems too with the legal landscape now is that most of these people, or all of them really, have qualified immunity, which means that they're sued in their official capacity. So they didn't actually pay a personal price. You know, Rob Flaherty, who's left the office, we sued his office. So he's actually not going to suffer any consequence whatsoever, even if we win. And that I think doesn't really dissuade people from engaging in the problematic behavior. So I think you're right that maybe the solution always lay with legislation that provides for, you know, actual penalties from the individual, not the taxpayers.
Yeah, I think if it's not enough, if the Supreme Court is going to require this sort of traceability standard, it's impossible, which is impossible to meet. There just needs to be legislation, right? So like there needs to be radical transparency by the government every time it talks to the social media companies. It needs to justify it. And then there needs to be penalties, right? If the government official goes and the DOD says, look, this please don't publish troop movements, that's like logged somewhere, and then ex post is determined that there wasn't troop movements being there wasn't ex there wasn't it wasn't like they were not asking about troop movements but something else. Then if it was troop movements, they're not going to be sued. They're not liable under this new law. But if it's like censored COVID information, then they'll be liable, right? So you need to like make that visible. If you're going to censor, it better be censorship of illegal speech.
Right.
Demands for censorship. I do think I don't see how this ruling stands. It's so at odds with the civic religion of this country, which is in favor of free speech. It's just a very strange political moment and legal moment where you have a bare majority of justices and a small plurality of power, of political power, who are in favor of this sort of fundamental violation of free speech rights. I just don't see how it stands. I think there's still more beats to come here.
I hope so. And I mean, one thing the court did say is that she sort of kept emphasizing no standing in the preliminary injunction context. I mean, technically, I don't know what the big difference is. But there is, I guess, this idea that it is emergency relief. And so maybe we can differentiate in the future. I don't, you know, we'll have to see. But we did have some good news last week and from the Supreme Court, too. There were actually two cases. One might be more relevant to our discussion, but Jarkissi, which said that the SEC has to give jury trials when they're charging people with offenses that involve civil penalties. So I believe that the plaintiff here had, was charged with some SEC violation, faced millions of dollars in civil penalties, and was only entitled to a so-called trial before an administrative law judge who's not independent. They're part of the SEC, so the prosecutor and the judge are not independent from each other, which is shocking. And this is obviously unconstitutional. So the Supreme Court said no. The Seventh Amendment guarantees you the right to a jury trial in such and such circumstances. So that was good news. And then perhaps more importantly even was Loper Bright slash Relentless, which actually came out of our office. My colleague John was the lead attorney on Relentless. And that was a case in which I think the National Marine something services, an agency, was charging fishermen $700 a day to be regulated under their own requirements to have an observer on board or something when they go out into the waters. And for a lot of small family-owned businesses like the plaintiffs, that was basically bankrupting them. They just couldn't afford the $700 a day. And they alleged that the agency didn't have the congressionally delegated authority to make this rule that required them to pay $700 a day. And the court agreed and but fundamentally struck down this case called Chevron, which had said that when a statute is ambiguous, the court should defer to the agency's interpretation of its own rule, which just gives agencies a lot of power. So I think Jay and I and many other people have probably been thinking about, well, the next time there's a pandemic or there's some kind of mask rule or vaccine mandate, what will that mean for Americans now that Chevron is dead? And I don't know how much thought you've given it, but if you have some ideas, we'd love to hear them.
I saw both those rulings, especially the second one. Seems like it's very, very, very important. I mean, the first one was important, of course, as well. But
the first one is important too because there are a lot of agencies that have these administrative tribunals that could actually significantly affect your rights. So I think now those it's not just this one, and not just the SEC. But anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. So I mean, both of those seem to take the power out of the hands of these administrative agencies. The bureaucracy, and put it into the court system, and it's interesting. So let me just give you my experience with the courts, which are almost all entirely stem from the pandemic. Right, I was an expert witness in dozens and dozens of anti-lockdown, anti-mask mandate, anti-vaccine mandate cases through the pandemic, including some the recent Supreme Court. As an expert, I was like the pro bono expert on a crazy number of these cases. And the most frustrating thing, especially in 2020, is that the court essentially said you have some expert on the other side said, oh, the CDC says this that cloth masks work, and then the court just says, oh yeah, the cloth mask works because the CDC says it works. The amount of deference given to the agencies, even if you compile vast amounts of scientific evidence to the contrary, it was very frustrating as an expert.
Yeah.
And, you know, the court would often use this kind of deference. And I don't know if they were like specifically, again, I'm sorry, I'm not a lawyer. I keep apologizing for that because they're like fundamentally.
You shouldn't apologize. That's a good thing.
The fringe epidemiology is difficult enough for me, Janine. So it's but yeah, I like the amount of deference that the court would give to the government was just shocking. And there were these like tests, rational basis.
Yeah.
Tests, which they would apply, which essentially said that the government could say anything it wanted. They had to take it as given as long as it seemed like they had a reason, whether the reason was good or bad or true or false. It didn't matter.
One reason this new decision might not impact this, I'll start with the negative and then go to the positive, is what the CDC did with mask mandates and also what the agencies did with vaccine mandates, I think was not final agency action. Maybe not. I think the vaccine mandates, I'm wrong. But the mask mandates, and it was not considered final agency action, which means technically you can't, it was just a so-called recommendation in quotes. So, you actually can't challenge it in court. And we kept running up against that. You couldn't say the CDC is wrong about this recommendation because it's just a recommendation. But then a lot of employers would rely on it for their requirements, actually, with both mask and vaccine mandates. So we had employees of Michigan State University and a couple of other places who were subject to vaccine mandates. And when we challenged those, they had natural immunity. So when we challenged those, the government would say, well, the CDC says natural immune people should get the vaccine. We're relying on that. It can't be irrational to rely on the CDC. And the judge would say, yep, you're right. I'm not a scientist. I don't want to look at this evidence. If the CDC says, makes the recommendation, then it's rational. But then you also can't challenge it because it's not final agency action. But I do think the spirit of these cases might cause judges not to just defer to the agencies in those circumstances.
Right. So like if so the distinction, if I understand it correctly, is a distinction between a regulation that goes that goes through like the Administrative
Notice
Procedure
and
Act.
comment. Yeah.
And then there's like public comment, and then it's published in the Federal
Yeah.
Register or something. And so the Chevron reversal has to do with those kinds of regulations that have gone through that process.
Yeah.
And those regulations often have things in them that are not in the laws that enable the age that the Congress never envisioned charging fishermen $700 for I mean that's not in the law that sort of created the agency,
Right.
and so the agencies are making up law and putting it into the Federal Register. But those things had to go still through a process, a public process where you could get public comment. And now the agency can't just make up the law. And at the very least, when they make up law in the guise of regulation, that's challengeable in court. Whereas before, under the Chevron doctrine, it wasn't challengeable in court, if I'm understanding.
I mean, it was technically challengeable, but it was very, very hard to win because the courts would defer to the agency's interpretation.
Right. Whereas like the CDC, what they're doing is their regulations are not actually formal regulations at all. As you said,
right.
They're just guidance.
Right.
But I was trying to say is like they have the force of law during the pandemic.
Yeah,
right?
exactly. Exactly. And there was like the CDC eviction moratorium where the CDC was fining you couldn't evict people and landlords who tried to evict people during COVID would be subject to fines. And actually our organization and some others challenged this and another organization got to the Supreme Court before we did. But they did so successfully and they said the CDC just didn't have this authority. So it didn't, you know, that was just like, the CDC didn't have this authority. It wasn't a deference issue, but this should reduce the power of agencies in such circumstances going forward. So I think it's some good news.
It is. I do think though that for the CDC in particular, the fact that they can cloak themselves in capital D, capital S science, and even when they're wrong, and be taken as if they were automatically true by judges is a major problem. Like, how do you challenge the CDC when it gets things deeply wrong in court, especially when it ends up hurting people, right? And so you end up, it's not Chevron deference, but it's almost like public health deference, implicitly embedded in how courts think about these matters. And I think again that it's going to take fundamental reform at the CDC in order to have this. So, for instance, one idea that I had for this is if the CDC is going to issue a guidance as if it were to have the power of law or regulation that has gone through the Administrative Procedures Act or whatever, force them to actually go through the Administrative Procedures Act, right? But
right.
If you're going to say we recommend mask mandates or whatever, or we recommend masking at scale, if you put it to the APA, then there's room for public comment. It takes time for there's like a delay so that people can like sit and consider whether it's a wise idea. I think those kinds of like guidance, if it's going to have the force of law, we'll have them actually go through the kinds of procedures that allow it to have that force of law.
Yeah, exactly. And the federal mask mandate, the one on planes, I think, and I think trains that go run or interstate. That did have the force of law. You had to wear a mask when you were on a plane or train. I know someone who got kicked off a plane actually for not wearing a mask.
Oh, I was flying the day it got that judge in Florida ruled it. null. People were like counting down. They're like, you could just see they were like, and there was this like huge, everyone took their all off all at once. Even the stewardesses were like, were celebrating it. It was really interesting to watch.
Yeah.
It was very clear that it was a government that was forcing people to do this thing. Contrary to what, by the way, what the scientific evidence was saying about the efficacy of these mask mandates. The scientific evidence was incredibly weak, and yet we were all forced to like comply with it as if it were a law that had been passed, even though it was just an executive order or a regulation or something.
Yeah, I'm so glad those times are over. I really hated the mask mandates and made flying so much more unpleasant, I have to say. Well, anyway, I don't want to hold you up anymore. I know you have things to get to. But this was a fascinating discussion, as always. Is there any final thoughts or anything you want to talk about that you haven't had a chance to?
Well, Janine, I think that there's obviously quite a lot more work to do. The setback with Missouri versus Biden is, if it's not permanent, right? It's going back down to the lower court, and hopefully we can make some progress there, and hopefully there are other cases that'll move. But I think those who are listening, go talk to your Congress people, talk to your senator, write letters to it, vote. So that vote for people that support the First Amendment, because it is under threat right now in ways that it has not been under threat, maybe only a few times in American history. There's been under threat. In effect, right now, we don't have free speech in this country.
No.
And I think that if people listening to this take that away from our conversation, and then act so that we tell our leaders that it's vital to have it, we can get it back.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I do think it might be one of the most egregious First Amendment violations in U.S. history, especially considering the scope, because it affects so many millions of people at least. And then the impact, which was to stifle the debate during COVID and will stifle many other debates going forward, so that Americans don't really have the full panoply of opinions before them to make their own judgments about what's true and false and right and wrong.
Yeah. But
thank you so much, Jay. Thanks for your time. I know it's precious, and
thank you.
Hope to talk to you soon.
Bye now.